Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Oh, naive little me, asking what things you have seen, and you're vulnerable in your head. You're screaming your will to your dead. Creatures veiled by night, following things that are unright, and they're tired and they need to be led. You're screaming your will to your dead.
Welcome to Free State, everyone. Today we're joined by Amanda Brown. Amanda's book, No Peace Until He's Dead, is a story of, as it says on the front cover, my story of child abuse at the hands of Davy Tweed and my journey to recovery. Amanda, you're very welcome to Free State.
Thank you.
Can't believe she's so small.
Can't believe that.
Well, it says she's not the size of two good turf. or my grandmother, God rest her, said not the size of a double daisy.
Well,
And so full of charisma, so charismatic. I have to say, man, I was very distressed reading this book. In fact, I had to stop. It was so distressing. And just for the listeners, Davy Tweed was a very famous Irish rugby international. Was a DUP politician. He was in the Orange Order, Black Preceptory. He was a very powerful man in many ways, publicly. And the book is really a very harrowing tale about the true Davy Tweed, you know, the horrific reign of terror. And I just wanted to start the book is immensely moving, and I want to come back to the writing of the book. Davy Tweed was 61 when he was killed while riding his motorbike along a quiet road in Dunseverick. They said he snapped his neck. I wondered what it felt like. I thought about that for a long time. I tried to imagine his last moments. I tried to imagine his death. What way he might have fallen if he had suffered. My brother said he was killed instantly, but I was bothered by that. Apparently the paramedics tried to revive him, and I clung to that, hoping he was conscious at least long enough for his life to flash before his eyes and think about me. Did he regret what he did? Did he hear the screeches and howls of the demons in hell as his neck took his weight and ended him there and then? Did he lie there dying and wish he could change it? Oh, jeez. Wow. I mean, it's... You've never written before, no?
No.
It's an absolutely extraordinary piece of work. I mean, I was so distressed at times I had to stop. At one point, I wept. I rang him and I said, oh, Jesus.
When did you write that chapter? Was that the first thing you wrote?
Yep, that chapter was the first, very first chapter that I wrote, and that's what I sent to Merrion Press before they agreed to publish a book.
Really?
Mm-hmm. It was just on that one chapter.
Because one of the theme of peace and freedom is kind of one of the themes beyond just the harrowing details of the story, you know, that sense of being free. Your mother says, like, at one point, we'll have no peace until he's dead, which is the title of the book. And when he died, like, it is extraordinary. He had been released. He'd been released from prison at that stage.
He was one of those characters that was just insidious, you know, and even whenever he had been removed from the house, there was still constant, you know, there was just, he would nitpick or he would just show up places, you know, and it was just, there was just always something that you were constantly worrying about, looking behind you to see whether he was coming behind you.
It's a very strong feeling in the book of the life that could have been, because your own father, your descriptions of him, you know. I loved the feeling of being in my dad's arms. I remember dinner, hot and bowls on the table with the four of us together. The smell of cooking onions brings me back to that table with all of us together when everything was right and all was well. My favourite was mince and gravy with dots of carrots my mum had chopped into it, poured steaming over hot buttered spuds. Small bites now, love, mum would say. And, you know, the stories about playing in the snow and a very idyllic childhood described. And then, you know, a different life whenever this sort of heroic rugby international came on the scene and swept your mum into his arms. And
he was a sort of funny, you loved him being about the place. That was the original.
Yeah, initially he would have been, you know, funny and engaging, and, you know, there would have been that kind of playfulness, you know, that you would probably have with children,
you know. And enormous, like, he was an enormous man.
Yeah. So, you know, there would have been, like, piggyback rides and things that as well. Do you know that?
I mean, even now as an adult, you're 5 foot.
Yes.
You know, I mean, as a child, he must have seemed like a giant.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And immediately, but very quickly, he was violent first. Jealousy and all those kind of things and violent towards your mother.
Yeah, he began fairly quickly to turn, you know, and start to control and manipulate her. And there was that coercive control element and, you know, the pushing to see how far he could go and the apologies whenever he thought he pushed too far, and that would then rein her back in again. And, you know, we're aware of the cycles, you know, of these people and how they, you know, they get round and push harder and harder each time.
One of the most disturbing things about it, you're working in the redemption of women who have suffered this sort of horrific abuse, which is all too frequent in our society, as we know. But I think that one of the very chilling parts of it is the way you paint the scene, how he set it up. You know, to start it all seemed very idyllic, you know. But soon she couldn't know what mark or wrinkle Davy would find after scanning the room for a while. She couldn't foresee that the spoon in the sink would upset him when it never had before, or that the fingerprint in the window mine would be simply too much for him to bear. "I pulled you from the gutter," he would hiss against her face as he dragged her down the hall away from us to continue the conversation. "You are nothing. Nobody else would want a single mother." You know, and how, I mean, maybe you would talk a bit about, just from the respect of other women and your own experience here, about how he set that scene where suddenly over a period of time, this reign of terror just became your norm, your reality.
I think in situations like this, a lot of people ask the question, why did she not leave? And it's asked, and you hear it a lot of women who are stuck in situations like this, or, you know, who don't leave until something very serious happens. And people very quickly do ask, why did she not leave? And I wanted to articulate in the best way I could throughout my book as to why you don't leave. And it's that same analogy of, you know, if you put a frog in, you know, boiling water, it's going to jump out. But if you put it in cold water and start raising the temperature slowly, you know, it's cooked before it realises. And these kind of relationships are just the same as that. You know, they start off small, and they, you know, the way that they push you becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, because by that stage they have managed to manipulate you into, you know, either believing that it's your fault, or believing that, you know, you owe them something, or you wouldn't survive without them. They, you know, they create this dependence on them so that they can continue on with what they're doing.
And he isolated you as well, didn't he? He moved you away from kind of the family network, and it was, it became a more and more isolated, dependent situation.
Yeah, that is exactly, and that happens, you know, with, you know, in almost every situation where there's isolation that occurs. And
but more frightening than that is the fact that even without the isolation, him being such a public figure, you guys living in an estate, with families all around you, you know, and the, you could talk a bit about, one of the things that's very striking is that he kept repeating the same things to you and the same things to your mother, these propagandistic, you know, ideas that ultimately you began to believe that it was your fault, that it was your mother's fault. You know, look what this bitch has made me do. Look what this slut is doing to you. Mm-hmm. And if it weren't for me, you would be living on the street.
Yep.
You know, so that, you know, almost by the force of, we'll come back to it later about what happened later when your mom started to try and leave, and he would phone, and it would be this constant same message to you, this constant same message to your mother, almost in a way, as you describe it, where you would doubt your own sanity. That this, like, is this right? Am I completely offbeam about this? Maybe you could talk a bit about how he sort of completely brainwashed you into believing that this was okay.
Well, with the situation with my mum, I don't know if she ever felt that it was okay. But certainly, she did feel as if, you know, she deserved it, and this was the life that she chose. And, you know, she lived in fear, she lived in terror, you know, for the most part. She was frightened of what he would do, and he threatened quite frequently that he would take us away from her. And she believed that he would do that, you know, and not even just that, it was the threats of violence and the threats of harm and hurt.
Yeah, I mean, not that it would make any difference, but your mother was a very hard-working mother who looked after, I mean, you describe a life of service for the kids and service for Davy while he was working, and making sure that everything was just so, accompanying from the rugby matches, you know, and you know, not a drink problem or any problems. I mean, everything, I suppose, to the outside world must have seemed idyllic.
To the outside world, everybody would have thought that this was just a normal, happy family.
And you would sit, or you'd stand in the tunnel at rugby matches and, you know, come out at the end of the game. Like, it was that kind of idyllic picture being painted.
Mum was always standing, you know, at the side of the pitch whenever he was coming off, and he would call her onto the pitch as he was coming off, so that he could then walk off with her and with whichever one of my sisters in his arms, to give this impression that he was a real family man.
Yeah, like the philandering US senator, you know, calling his wife and children, his beloved wife and children, up on the stage and smiling, you know, with her ultra-bite smiles to the crowd. And but even more frightening, I thought when I read it, was that Davy, because of his position in the Orange Order, playing rugby for Ulster, larger than life, you know, a man's man, very friendly with the police, the local police, were very well connected politically. I mean, the police knew that this was going on. I mean, early on in the book you write, when the police were called by the neighbours, as became a pattern with Davy, they would arrive, simply shrug their shoulders and leave, each and every time. I mean, on one occasion, and I think this was where I became very, very distressed, he had beaten your mother very badly and had beaten her out onto the street. And neighbours had happened to see it. So it was okay in a way when it was behind doors and they could hear the screams and the great distress of your mum. But this one spilled out onto the street. And you describe neighbours gathering with cudgels and other weapons. And Davy arming himself with knives. And you're smiling, but I mean, it's extraordinary the fortitude that you've shown. Davy putting knives into the band of his belt, arming himself with a baseball bat and going out to take them on. You know, and as the crowd started to jostle and it became extremely violent, the police arrived. And I just wondered, he took a pellet gun from above the fridge, grabbed my brother's baseball bat, left the house. The men circled Davy like wolves around a large animal. And this would have been an area where it would have been, certainly there would have been plenty of paramilitaries, plenty of sort of, you know, people who could handle themselves. Davy went for one of them. The circle exploded. Someone struck Davy in the face. He staggered back. "Stop it," my mum shouted. "It's not right."
And your mother tried to protect him?
Yeah. Yeah, she threw herself in the middle of it to try and protect him, yeah.
We heard the sounds of police cars.
Yep.
The police came to the door, asked him if he had a gun. He said he didn't. They asked him for the baseball bat. He gave them that. They took the bat and went away.
That's my brother's bat, yeah.
We were sent straight to bed and that was the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is the law. These are the people who are supposed to protect you. And we'll come to the horrendous abuse that you suffered. But, I mean, I suppose what age would you have been then?
Then, yeah, about maybe six.
Six, 7 years of age.
Well, so not as old as seven. I've been about five or
that
six.
It must have seemed to you in a way that Davy was part of the establishment, the system of law and order, and therefore we're powerless when it comes to him. Because the police protect him.
Mm-hmm.
He's protected here locally. He's viewed throughout the country as a hero. And therefore, this is the way our lives are going to be.
Yeah, well, back then as well, the police didn't get involved, really, in situations like that. You know, it was just another domestic and that's what it was notched up to. It wasn't until, I think, the 90s that the policy started to change around that. But, you know, yeah, they turned off at the door plenty of times. It was like, oh, it's just another domestic, and off they went, as if like a man had a right to beat his wife. Do you know, and that's kind of the attitude that there would have been at that time as well, you know, when people didn't get involved, they turned a blind eye. So the fact that these men circled and tried to do something about it was a huge deal then. Yeah. And my mum didn't understand what was going on. She didn't understand why they were there. So she just thought that it was unfair that there was all of these people against this one man. So she stepped in to try and protect him then.
I mean, I suppose in a way it just illustrates how completely bizarre your world became.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have to say for the listeners, I mean, I would recommend this book to anyone. I mean, it's I'm amazed that it's your first effort at writing. It's brilliantly written because it's written in a very simple way. It's written without adornment or any attempt to create effects. You know, Dion would be more literary than I am, but that simplicity of the writing and the beauty of the writing makes it all the more horrifying. I mean, you write about your father frequently suggesting to your mother, "Look, I am backed by very powerful people." He was saying to her, "Like, do you not get who I am, Margaret? I know a guy who will fucking cut you up with a chainsaw." And no doubt your mummy believed that.
Oh yeah, yeah. We had no reason to believe that he was not capable of the things that he said that he would do.
Because he was doing them.
Yeah.
He was.
On top of the violence, though, like he would threaten, kill my mum, mm. you know, and he had threatened to burn the house down with my younger sisters in it. And we, you know, we had no reason to believe that he wouldn't do that.
Yeah. You say at one stage, and it is interesting because, like, most, you know, there would be the idea of it being, you know, the work angel, house devil, or one of those cliches. But you say the sides of Davy, you talk about, you know, how he was regarded in the community and all this. The sides of Davy, the one we knew and the one they knew outside, I think those were the same side, in that it was just that his ferocity and need to control things worked for the community, but it worked against us.
Yeah.
And that's a great, it's just a really powerful image that it wasn't actually, there was, you know, a split person. It was the same person wherever he was, just, and this need for control and power, and he wanted to be, he just wanted to bully whoever he could.
Yeah.
Would that be you?
Well, yeah, it's like, there was the two different personalities in terms of how he wanted to present to the world what his home life was like. That yeah. was something different. But if you really wanted to scratch the surface, and if anybody has scratched the surface, and look at who he was on the rugby pitch, he was aggressive on the rugby pitch.
Yeah.
And who he was within, you know, his political career, he was aggressive there as well. And, you know, he was very aggressive in the parades.
Yeah, the DUP wasn't extreme enough for him. I mean, I remember your stepfather during the, you know, one of the most notorious episodes of the entire Troubles were the what were described as the Harryville protests at mm-hmm. the church at Harryville, as your father would have said, the Roman Catholic Church at Harryville, where the parishioners going into mass were assaulted, you know, missiles thrown. But I remember your stepdad in the middle of that shouting, screaming, "Fucking paedophiles! Fucking paedophiles!" I mean, that's not an exaggeration. I mean, as scary as that, wasn't it? Like,
yeah.
Did he ever bring you guys to these protests?
No, we were never at any of those.
I mean, there's footage of him. I think you actually referred to it in the book, of him doing that. Yeah, fucking paedophiles! Shouting at the priest when the priest was trying to get into the chapel. And I suppose that every now and again in life, you meet a truly evil individual. Like, it's very, I'm a criminal barrister, so I know that the vast majority of people who I see, and I do very, very serious cases, are there through circumstance mostly, and have, you know, have always, almost always redeeming features. But it's rare to find a truly evil human being. And that's what this man is. When you read, I mean, it's the inescapable, it's a terrible thing to say about anyone, but it's very difficult to reach any other conclusion.
Yeah. And that's what he was, though, to us.
And does that lighten your burden to know that it's not, you know, like, you can just say, look, this guy was a monster and we were so unlucky to come across him, but, you know, enough's enough, he's not going to destroy the rest of my life. There's a sense of that from you.
I think it's, you know, throughout my own healing journey as well, like, I've got to a place of acceptance and accepting him for who and what he is. And that then has allowed me to sort of let go of it. You know, I spent an awful lot of time, 2 years, I spent trying to find forgiveness for him.
Yeah.
And, you know, in that, tried to find a reason as to why he would be the way he is, why he would do what he has done. But I couldn't justify it. I couldn't make it.
And you say in the book that actually that, because you know, that was part of that, you know, therapeutic journey. And then you saw that forgiveness was actually, this idea was making things a lot worse for you.
Yeah, I began to believe that I was as bad as he was because I couldn't find it in myself to forgive him.
Yeah, I mean,
and that's almost like when you go back to the beginning when you were a kid, and that idea that you write about, if my mum got battered, I would find something I did to explain it. So it's almost a connection from that to that, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Your also, your memory of it's very vivid. Like, it's very striking. I don't know if you feel able to talk about the first time that he sexually abused you, you know, but in the book, it's, you know, he was clearly, I think what you're trying to say is you couldn't fully understand what he was watching on the television. It was late at night. You got up to go to the loo and he was clearly watching pornography. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you felt able to talk about it, if you felt that it was helpful for others to talk about it, but I'm really
I don't know that talking about the detail of it would be in any way helpful, but in terms of, like, at that time, I had no understanding of what was going on. I had no understanding of what was actually happening there. And I know you've said there that
it was more the way what I meant really, Amanda, was the way he presented it to you. I didn't mean the detail of the actual abuse. I meant the way he presented it. Can you do me a favor, honey?
Mm-hmm.
You know, sit beside me here and wake me for work so I won't miss my shift. You know, and you saying, as I say, something felt really off about all of this, but I didn't know what else to do. So I just agreed, you know. And then pretending to be asleep while he does what he's doing. And then this crying child, and he says, why are you crying? Has something happened?
Yeah.
And you must have felt you were mental. Yeah. That you were going mental.
Yeah, but it was all part of his game of trying to pretend that he didn't know what was happening. So he, you know, he really very, very intentional in what he was doing. And I know I've come across people who have said, oh, he's sick. He's sick in the head. And I don't accept that. I don't accept it when people say that he's sick in the head. He was very intentional. He knew what he was doing. He could have. He made a choice.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I must have mistook you for mum, he said.
Yeah, yeah.
When you said to him, what was that? I must have mistook you for mum.
Mm-hmm. People would very often say that I was very like my mummy. They still do. You know, they say I'm very like my mummy in looks and, you know, she's a very small statured woman as well.
But what she must have, what were you, what age were you at that time?
I mean, then what, yeah. I was seven.
You know.
When Joe said about it being very vivid, and you were going to say something there about that.
Yeah, about that my memory was very vivid. Mm. It's like I have, and I keep saying this, and this is the best way that I can explain this, and I hope that somebody else gets something out of this as well, is that my memories were like jigsaws thrown onto a table and the boxes had been taken away. So I had to take those jigsaws and create a picture. And some of the pictures are very jumbled, but that was one clear picture that I was able to create to bring to the police because I knew I needed a clear picture for the police. So I had to work hard trying to piece that together. And that's why I say that that was my first clear memory. I have other memories that are from a younger age, but because I don't have like a complete picture, because similar things happened frequently in the same place, so the memories are slightly jumbled, you know.
Because you say that after that first incident, it then just happened almost every night. Mm-hmm. See, Amanda, Davy said to me, if you told anyone what I did by mistake to you, police would send me to jail. And if that happened, you and your mum and Aaron and the baby would all have to live in the street. You'd have nothing. You'd have no food. You'd have nothing at all. Mm-hmm. And I mean, until you said to him, I promise I won't tell the police. I promise I won't tell anybody. He said, oh, that's a good girl. You know, fantastic. You know, because we want to keep your mummy and the other kids safe. I mean,
and who was in the house at that time? Just for the listeners.
It would have been my mum, my younger sister, and my older brother.
Yeah. And what age were you then when you decided that the way out of it was to get adopted by JVT?
I believed that I was the only person. I believed that it was just me. I had no idea. Like, I spent my entire existence watching my younger sisters so closely, thinking that I would see something, and I never did. So I always believed that it was just me. And I thought, you know, I was trying to work out why it was just me, why he was doing this to me. And the only thing that I could see was that I wasn't his actual daughter. And I thought that if he seen me as his actual daughter, that he would leave me alone. So I asked then, could I be adopted by him? My mum was against the adoption, but she was happy enough for us to change our names.
The way it's handled in the book, it's... you know, of all the shocking things that are in it, in a way, this is the most shocking, because this child is trying frantically to figure out how to not be abused. And if you don't mind, I'll just read this passage. I want Dave, it's the start of a paragraph of a chapter. It was chapter 6. I want Davy to adopt me, I said from the back seat of the car. We were on our way home from a big rugby match in Belfast. You see, I had had a brainwave. I had the sudden idea that the only reason Davy abused me was because I wasn't his flesh and blood. So if I was adopted, he would stop. Jesus Christ. And you actually had your name changed by deed, Paul. You were so determined about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose in a way that because your mother didn't know about the abuse, that represented to your mother... she loves Davy. She really loves Davy. And I suppose reinforced with your mum then, you know, if I do anything about this, it's going to jeopardise the children.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, he was doing all this with her as well.
Yep.
So, I mean, it was an extraordinary mental prison, wasn't it? You know, as you describe it. Tell us about changing your name by deed, Paul.
It was kind of my mum that done all... the paperwork side of things, but I know we had to go through a process where we had to ask my dad for permission, and you know, I'm aware that that whole situation further alienated then us, you know, from our dad as well. So yeah, it kind of played into Davy's hands, you know. In hindsight, I can look at that now, but at the time, I was doing what I could to try and survive what I was going through.
And you there's a really, like, there's so many moments in the book where, again, you just feel like just like reaching out and kind of, you know, somehow saving you. But there's that moment where you say, when you're visiting your dad, your actual dad, and, you know, you're in the house and your stepmother was carrying a pot of tea in, and you wanted to shout, I want to, let me stay. But I didn't. The words crowded in my throat and made it burn, but I held them back. I did want to live there. It was lovely and calm and safe. But you couldn't say it.
No, I couldn't. There was, again, that need in me to try and protect my mum as well. Do you know, if I didn't have that desire or need to try and protect her, I probably would have just kicked up a fuss. And
he was always the victim. He was always the victim. I mean, the story you tell about him crashing the car when you were all in the car, I mean, it's a demonstration of his... That's why I said that it's rare to see something, you know, to come across and encounter someone who's truly evil. See, his complete pathological disregard for you and your mum and your half siblings. I mean, your description, the car crashed, came to a stop. There was nothing but the sound of the engine. Davy kicked the smashed windscreen out and left the vehicle that way without so much as a look in his wife's direction. There she was, 7 months pregnant after a bad crash. He didn't so much as glance at her. He left us there and walked home. A man appeared at the side of the car and opened the door, took my mum out, then us, took us to the closest house to where the crash was. None of us knew where Davy had gone. It's absolutely extraordinary.
Tell us about...
Where had he gone?
He had gone out to speak to the other person who had pulled out in front of us, and I think he had had a bit of an argument with them. So, but I didn't actually see him until he came back home from hospital again. I didn't see him the rest of that night.
And you said you wanted him, when you heard he was staying in hospital, you hoped that he'd die.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I did, yeah.
And when you had those feelings, like, what did you think? Like, was that a, did you feel like, were you again, was because of the mental torture he had enacted on you, were you feeling guilty for having those feelings, or?
I didn't feel guilty for having those feelings. I think whenever I was younger, it was just a case of, I knew that if he just died, then we would be okay.
Yeah.
Do you know, we would be fine.
Yeah. I suppose you're just at a very basic stage of just wanting to survive.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, it's like, I suppose being, I'm trying to think, like, of being a prisoner in a very brutal prison camp, something like that. Would that be?
Well, yeah. But, you know, you have this, you're also led to believe that you're free to walk away at any time. So you're led to believe that you choose to stay in that, that it's somehow your own fault.
You have no idea, no idea how it feels to be on your own. In your own home, with a fucking phone and the mother of gloom. In your bedroom, standing over your head with a hand in your head. With a hand in your head. I will not pretend, I will not put on a smile. I will not say I'm alright for you, not I. One of us to be good, to do everything in trouble. To do everything in trouble. I wish, I wish, I wish I was born a man. So I could learn how to stand up for myself. Like those guys with guitars, I've been watching the bars. Who've been stamping their feet to a different beat, to a different beat, to a day. Beat. I will not pretend, I will not put on a smile, I will not say I'm alright for you, not I. One of us to be good, to do everything in true, to do everything in true. You bloody motherfucking asshole, oh, you bloody motherfucking asshole, oh, you bloody motherfucking asshole, oh, you bloody motherfucking asshole.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.